I find joy in my life.
By reading quietly.
Through laughter. Through exercise.
In my hobby of baking.
With my family and friends.
In being in nature.
In running.
In investing in the relationships that bring my life meaning.
When I can put my toes in the sand and hear the crashing of the waves.
Welcome to Joy of Medicine On Call, where we explore the many paths physicians take to find joy in our practice of medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Yellowleaves, and I look forward to your engagement in this exciting program from the Sierra Sacramento Valley Medical Society. Okay, well, today we're with Dr. Rich Kaplan, who's the chairman of the Department of Cardiology and is also clearly a cardiac surgeon at the Mercy of San Juan Medical Center. Now, Rich, first of all, thank you very much indeed for coming here. I know you've got a long-time interest in physician well-being and are very involved in that in your day-to-day work. But I gather that you weren't too sure about becoming a doctor, and I actually understand that you hated your first year at medical school. So maybe let's start going back there before we work through your background a little bit as to try and investigate why it is you're so interested in physician health and well-being.
Starting with my first year of medical school, and we'll circle back to wellness, medical school was a bit of a surprise for me. I guess when I was, you know, 3 or 4 years old, like every little boy, I had some idea of what I wanted to be when I grew up, and it wasn't a fireman and it wasn't an astronaut. I decided I wanted to be a doctor. And so I stayed on that path somewhat unflinchingly, unthinkingly, until I got to medical school. As an undergraduate, I had studied philosophy and actually did a master's in philosophy. And so around the time I finished up my undergraduate and graduate education, I was sitting in seminars with 6 or 7 other people having, at the time, what I thought were very profound discussions. And I get to medical school, and I'm sitting in a class of 200 people being lectured biochemistry and really had no interest. Found myself sitting in the back row doing the New York Times crossword puzzle, bothering my classmates for a, you know, 7-letter word for resilience or something. What changed for me was third-year rotations. Walked into an operating room as a clinical rotation, fell in love with surgery, and haven't looked back since.
So that's really interesting. I mean, how old were you when you actually first decided you were going to go to medical school? I mean, how far back are we talking about?
Young childhood. You know, whatever age that is when you're trying to decide between being a fireman and president.
Right. And can you remember what influenced you on that?
I was an asthmatic as a child.
Right.
Spent a fair bit of time with our pediatrician. And I think he was bigger than life and a role model. And he was a grown-up man who took the time to talk to me and listen to me and cared about me. And I think that was very influential.
Right. Now, that's interesting. I mean, I'm asking because, you know, that's what we find in a lot of doctors. I mean, people make these decisions, at least half of physicians do, incredibly early in their lives. And you know, obviously for you, it's been a good decision.
Absolutely been the right decision.
Right.
No regrets.
Well, it's really good to hear. So obviously you enjoyed your rotations, decided that surgery was the thing for you, and have obviously gone on to a very stellar career in cardiac surgery. What sort of was your impression of being a resident?
I trained at NYU back in the 1980s, and it was very much the old boys club. It was a brutal residency. We were on call every other night in the hospital for 5 years, came in Monday morning at 5:30 in the morning, went home Tuesday night at 11 o'clock at night, came back Wednesday morning at 5:30 in the morning, went home Thursday night at 11 o'clock, and so on for the next 5 years, and didn't know any better. You know, it was a very rigorous program. It was not a pyramid. They had done away with the pyramid, but there was very little forgive. I think we were accepting of the norm. That's just how it was. We didn't know any better. And in fact, in looking back on it, I loved my residency. Yes, it was brutal. Yes, I was obviously chronically fatigued in ways that I could not appreciate at the time. But the camaraderie, the interactions with the patients, the other residents, the staff, the attendings, it was a highlight for me. I loved what I was doing. I was operating all the time, taking care of patients. Patients were appreciative. It was exciting.
So I'm guessing you literally lived in the hospital then. I mean, those were the days when people used to be given their own apartment.
As expected, I married a nurse. who else would I have met? And she likes to talk about my chief residency year. So part of NYU is Bellevue. I started out my chief residency year as the trauma chief at Bellevue for 3 months, June, July, and August. And as she will tell you, I came home for 6 hours the first month. Literally, she would meet me in the parking lot to give me clean clothes, clean underwear, clean scrubs. I didn't make it home much. It was brutal.
Right. So tell me, I mean, obviously, you know, life is different nowadays. I mean, what do you think of residents nowadays when they come to talk to you about the difficulties doing an 80-hour week?
I think there's an upside and a downside. I think this is a great area to explore. I don't pretend to know the answers. I do think today's residents are more cerebral than we were, more insightful, more balanced, but I also think they're less well-trained. I look at the general surgery residents coming out of training. By the time I finished my general surgery residency, I could operate. I could take care of patients. I was safe to go out and practice. I don't know that that's true nowadays in general. I think the 5 years of general surgery that still exists is a good starting point, but really not a complete training. And part of that is the hours. There's a lot of pathology out there, and it just takes time and experience to see enough to be safe.
Now, I mean, I think you're right. But so I'm interested to know how you feel that compares with some of the European systems of training, you know, where, in some, for instance, the Northern European countries, doctors are literally doing 40-hour weeks.
They're doing 40-hour weeks once they're in practice. They do train in that manner, but they also, it's a very broad statement. So I did part of my graduate school in England, so I spent some time at Cambridge and had friends who studied medicine. They begin their medical training much earlier. They don't do 4 years of a liberal arts education. Mm-hmm. So what we would consider college, they're already in the equivalent of med school. So their process is elongated. That said, I do think that there is a certain maturity and wisdom that comes with age, and there is no substitute, and it just takes time. I think by the time you get to be old and fat and gray like I am, you've been doing this long enough where a 40-hour week would be lovely because you've seen enough. But I think starting out, there's a definite disadvantage. There's a trade-off there.
So moving on, I mean, I think, you know, it sounds like you obviously did well in your residency. Tell me a bit about your practice. I mean, from what I can see, you did a lot of research early on and worked with a number of stellar people.
I was very fortunate. I trained at some wonderful institutions and had the opportunity to meet and work with some really outstanding people. My plan was to be an academic surgeon. It never occurred to me to go into private practice. I did my general surgery, like I said, at NYU, and my cardiac surgery at the Cleveland Clinic, did a transplant and artificial heart fellowship at Columbia Presbyterian, and my first job was the director of the artificial heart program at the University of Miami. I had an NIH-funded lab, and life was great. My wife and I were living in Miami, and we had no plans of changing that pathway. What changed for us was we had a daughter. She's now 19 and at university, but she was just a baby then. And literally I got a call out of the blue when she was about 1.5 years old from one of my now partners saying, "Hi, you don't know me, but I trained at the Cleveland Clinic about 10 years ahead of you. Our senior partner just went out on disability. Do you want to come look at a job?" And I said, "Thanks, no thanks," and hung up. Well, that started a conversation with my wife and myself about raising a family in South Beach. South Beach was great when it was the two of us, not a great place to raise a daughter. When my partner called back a couple weeks later and said, "Are you sure you don't want to come look at a job?" Decided I should go look, came out here, looked at the practice, met the partners, fell in love with Sacramento, and have not looked back since.
So that's a big change in both professional approach and, I'm guessing, lifestyle. I mean, can you talk a bit about that?
So the advantage of being in private practice for me, I have outstanding partners. I trust them completely. If I needed surgery or if someone I love needed surgery, that's who'd be operating on them. And so it really affords me the ability that when I'm off, I'm off. When I was in academia, I was never really off. If I took a week's vacation, I always had a grant or a paper or something else that I had to do. And there was really very little downtime. Yes, the rigors of the day-to-day life were better because I had residents and fellows and that sort of thing, But the responsibilities never let up. In private practice, the days are busier, but as you progress through the years, you learn to be efficient. You learn to be more clinically astute, and so I think it gets you through your day in a more reasonable manner. But when you're off, you actually have downtime, which I think is critical to your own well-being.
So tell me, what do you do in your downtime?
Mostly I spend it with my family. We're a very close family. There are four of us. I have two daughters. As much as I say we're close, both my daughters are at school on the East Coast. But my wife and I have been married for 26 years now, and we're incredibly close. I go to the gym every day. I do love doing yard work. I love being out back. But mostly we just spend time as a family.
So, I mean, it sounds like you've had several sort of iterations of your career in some respects.
Yes.
I mean, you now, I understand, you know, heading up the well-being process at Mercy San Juan. Can you tell me a little bit about why you went into that and what you do?
So it's actually for Mercy Medical Group. This was an unexpected change for me. Probably 3 or 4 years ago, I started thinking about going back to school. I had started a PhD in philosophy while I was in med school. I was never able to complete my thesis because of clinical rotations. But at the end of the day, I am a nerd. I like reading. I like school. As much as I love cardiac surgery, I found that at this point in my life, being in my mid-50s, it is not that intellectually stimulating. It's fairly rote. I tend to stay up very late every night reading just for my own enjoyment. And it seemed like it was time to go back and do something with my want for further education. So looked around and found a program that I found really exciting. It's a combined MBA, MPH at Harvard for physicians only. And I have been attending that for the past 2 years. I graduate in about a month. And as much as I've loved it, it's time to move on. But really, it was while at Harvard, understanding and addressing the issues that face healthcare nowadays, looking at the empowered faculty, my incredibly advanced and intelligent and accomplished classmates, and trying to figure out, for me, my place in this world at this point in my career. The heart surgery is the easy part. Tremendous time is being spent talking about the cost of healthcare, and yes, that's a critical issue. But I actually believe that the foremost burning platform in healthcare is physician burnout. And I found over my 2 years there, I became fairly passionate about it. As I became more vocal within Mercy Medical Group and the leadership there understood my passion, and really I give credit to our CEO, Alan Schatzel, and our CMO, Ben Blatbot, for having the vision and the presence of mind to recognize how critical this is in this time, the moral imperative and the business imperative that burnout presents. They asked me to take on this task for the medical group, and that's what I'm doing now.
So it's interesting that you use the term the moral imperative, because, I mean, a number of people are now talking about burnout as being a moral injury. I'm sure you've read about those sorts of issues. How do you feel about that?
So I don't equate those two. By moral imperative, I meant that it is incumbent upon us to protect, help, nurture our healthcare providers. The moral injury aspect, actually, I struggle with. When I look at my Hippocratic Oath, it is certainly patient first and patient centric. And to think that anything that is not patient centric is moral injury, I take issue with. So when I hear physicians cringe at the term customer satisfaction, as much as we all have an inner cringe at that, that's exactly what we're here for. We are here to provide satisfaction to our patients. So as much as for most of my career, I thought that my having a low mortality rate in cardiac surgery was the best thing I could do for patients, yeah, that matters. But it also matters that they are pleased with their care. That's why they come to us. And there's actually really wonderful data. If you look back at Mass General has published this a number of times, what their mortality rates were in the 19th century. They were tremendous. And it really makes you question, why did people still go to doctors through the 19th and 18th centuries? Because most of them didn't survive. A lot of what we do, if not most of what we do, is hand-holding, understanding, compassion, caring. And I think that has a lot to do with why patients still come to us. That is integral to patient satisfaction. So to divorce that from what we do, to cringe at the term patient satisfaction or customer experience, I think we're missing the essence of our Hippocratic Oath. And so I don't see this as a moral injury. Mm-hmm. I see it as a systems and process issue that we need to improve for our providers. I do think one of the critical mistakes that we make, and I apologize for going on here, I'm sure you have more questions, but I'm sure you can tell that I'm fairly passionate about this. I do think that it's incumbent upon us not to blame providers. And I think to ascribe this to moral injury and to tell our providers that they need to do more yoga and eat more granola and, you know, mindful their way out of this is naive. I think this is a greater systems process issue. The system is broken, and we need to get our providers working at the top of their licensure, doing that which they love, and unburden a lot of the menial tasks that have them so encumbered.
And I 100% agree with everything you're saying, I have to say. Having said that, I think when people talk about a moral injury, what they're meaning more is that it's almost morally unreasonable to practice medicine in a dreadful environment. And that practicing medicine in the sort of environment you describe, and I completely agree with you, is almost exacerbating the problem. Now, I personally don't agree with that, but I'm interested to know what you think.
I think ideal environments won't need physicians. I'm not sure there's a good environment to practice medicine. You asked me earlier about my general surgery training. I described my training at Bellevue. Was that moral injury or was an exciting time? My dad's favorite TV show was MASH. So being in a mobile army hospital in, you know, Korea during the war was hardly a reasonable environment. You don't get to choose the environment within which you take care of people who are sick. And that's what we're here for. That's what our code is about. It's not about the environment. Is it difficult on the physicians? Yes. Do we need to do a better job of caring for our providers? Absolutely. But do I see that as a moral injury? I really don't.
So let's just move on a little bit and think about, you know, what you're doing now in this area. I mean, what sort of, you know, areas of interest do you want to develop and work on, you know, in your own, you know, medical group?
Great question. So I took on this role in January of this year. It's just 4 months, and I'm still very new to it. That said, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. I think we need three tasks or three approaches to deal with wellness. And none of this is new or genius or particular to me. I think first and foremost, there is a lot of attention paid to the electronic health record. I think the issues with the electronic health record really stem from the required documentation from CMS, and I think that's a legislative issue. Ashish Jha in his... I'm trying to remember the name of the paper that just came out from MedMass a couple months ago. I'm sure you saw it.
Sure.
Call to Action. I think he stated it really well. But that is the 30,000-foot legislative change that needs to come to deal with the electronic health record, which is not something that you'll be able to deal with where you are or that I'll be able to change for Mercy Medical Group. The other two aspects, though, that I think we can tackle. One, I think there need to be physician-directed issues. So as much as I say we're not going to yoga or granola our way out of this, I do think resilience training, resilience workshops, open conversation among practitioners, support groups among practitioners will help. And I think there's good data to support that when clinicians get together and share these issues, that there is actually an improvement in wellness. And I think the SSVMS has done a wonderful job with the Joy Medicine program to go ahead and support that and facilitate those meetings. And we've seen great work come from them because of it. But the third arm of this, and the one that I'm trying to focus on, is very much the process and systems issues. When I look at Mercy Medical Group, the places where we trip and trip very badly are with flexibility, accessibility, our ability to do simple tasks like refill prescriptions for patients. These are the issues that our doctors face every day. Primary care providers practically get accosted on a daily basis by unfortunate patients who come into their office in tears. They've been waiting 2 weeks for a prescription refill. They've been to their pharmacy. The pharmacist has sent over the request. the physician hasn't gotten the request. There's a breakdown in the system. And so you have irate patients. You have physicians who are frustrated with the mechanics of the system that feel horrible. They can't take care of these people. Mrs. Pesky is waiting for her beta blocker and is in trouble now because of a simple clerical error. I think these are the systems, these are the tasks that should be fairly straightforward to rectify once we've identified them. Right now, we are doing a lot of surveying of our providers, trying to understand their pain points. But what's really come out first and foremost is that it's the flexibility and the accessibility that our providers need to help care for their patients and to try and give them the support, particularly in the front office, to work at the top of their licensure.
So what about, you talked about flexibility a couple of times. I mean, do you see people working differently in the future? You know, maybe doing different types of consultations, working more from home, you know, varying their lives a bit more?
So this was fascinating for me. And this part of taking on wellness as a heart surgeon is a little bit incongruous because I live in a very fixed world. I live in a world where you stick out your hand and you say, let me have this, and somebody gives it to you. So my understanding of how to fix things is fairly concrete, and my appreciation for what other clinicians look for in their practice was very limited. So this has been pretty educational the past 4 months. I think our providers very much would like to change the way they practice. It does not need to be a 9 to 5 or 8 to 7 or pick your hours day job. There are many in our group who would love to have time mid-afternoon to pick up their kids from school, but absolutely have a chunk of time in the evening where they could do telemedicine. Our CEO, Alan Schatzel, was almost somewhat pioneering in his development of a telemedicine network for neurology. And I think those types of constructs would work very well. I know we have many clinicians that would love to work Saturdays as opposed to a different day during the week, which would also be remarkably advantageous to our patients who need those other times. So that sort of flexibility, having the time in our clinics of different hours than the norm, both from the patient side and the provider side.
So if you talk about that flexibility and you look back at your career, how could that have helped you if it had been more available, say, in earlier years?
That's going to take a moment of pondering. Again, because of the world that I've chosen, living in a cardiac OR, it is so structured, I'm not sure that flexibility applies there in the same way. I think what my partners and I did, and did well, is we built flexibility in the form of vacation time. There were 5 of us. We had 4 operating rooms. And so every 5th week, one of us was on vacation. So we had an almost mandated lengthy vacation frequently. And it kept us sane because we were working incredible hours. And so I think that was how we built in flexibility. Unfortunately, within the construct of heart surgery, it's a little bit hard to, you know, this is not something I can do at night in the garage or on weekends, although we do operate weekends as well.
What do you think about, the issues confronting female surgeons in particular? Because, again, in terms of raising families and trying to do surgery, I mean, there are many more surgery residents and younger female surgeons now around. How do you think they're going to manage?
I actually think they're going to manage just fine. I have 2 daughters. One is 16, one is 19. Neither has any remote interest in medicine. But that said, they are 2 of the most insightful, bright young people I've ever met. They have a much better handle and a much better appreciation of humanity, work-life balance than I ever did. I never thought about those things at their age. And I just think the cognitive world that we live in nowadays, they will go ahead and learn to function both at home and at work with a much more reasonable balance than we ever thought about. I look at young female surgeons nowadays. I've met some tremendous young and I kind of hate this conversation because I don't think of them as female surgeons. They're just surgeons. And I think we almost need to take that statement off the table. Their colleagues, their surgeons, their gender has nothing to do with what they do. Yes, there is some degree of conflict in terms of child rearing. They'll manage just fine.
Okay. So let's just move in one more final direction. One of your roles, I'm assuming, is to sort of try and assist any physicians who are getting burnt out or who are at risk of getting burnt out. What sort of things are you going to put in place so that either they can recognize that situation themselves or their colleagues can recognize it for them?
Great topic. So recognizing it for themselves, and this is personal philosophy. I actually can't show you data on this one, but I somewhat believe that anyone who has the insight to recognize it within themselves probably has the insight to catch themselves before they go too far down that path. I think recognizing it in colleagues is, recognizing it probably isn't the challenge. Being willing to talk about it and approach colleagues is the hard part. For all of the reasons that things are still taboo in our society, this is one of those taboo issues. We hold up our healthcare providers as superhuman. They're not allowed to get sick. They're not allowed to have issues. And we're very unforgiving as a society of any type of mental health issues. And this is a mental health issue. If you heard that your doc was drinking too much, you wouldn't have a hard time pulling him aside and getting him down a path of counseling. But suspecting that someone is burnt out and recognizing it and understanding the symptoms, we're much more careful about approaching that topic. As with everything else, though, I do think the answer is education. I think it's open conversation, like you and I are having now. It's education of all of our providers. And it is programs like the one provided by the SSVMS, where one can go and have anonymous counseling and seek help or be directed towards that if need be.
No, I think that's really important. I mean, because as much as anything else, this is actually about a cultural change within the profession. And that sounds like that's the direction you're moving in. What do you think is going to be the response of your colleagues in your group, you know, as you go down this path?
I actually think that they're going to embrace it. The first thing that we did when I took on this role was to revamp our Wellness and Resilience Committee. And I've been astounded at the number of people that want to be a part of this and the response that people have had to me. I think our providers understand their frustrations. I think they very much want things to get better. And I think they will elevate themselves to this challenge. But I think your term and your descriptor was exactly on the money. This is a culture change. We need to shift the culture and make this part of our world and make it acceptable.
So if we move forward 5 years and you've been doing this job for that time and you've been very successful, what would you hope to have achieved?
Ideally, I would like to see a group of providers with a better work-life balance. I would like to see a better return on investment for the medical group financially in terms of healthcare costs, in terms of absenteeism, in terms of people going to work in the morning and enjoying their jobs. And from a business side of things, I think the medical group will flourish because of it. We will see the benefits of those efforts.
Well, I have to say, I think it's great that you're in that position and the medical group's lucky to have you.
I'm very fortunate that they're willing to let me take this on. I think it's incredibly forward-thinking of the medical group. I'm astounded by institutions that don't have this vision. So I give them the credit.
Good. All right. Well, look, thank you very much for that. Now, we're going to finish off with a quick series of lightning round questions, which will hopefully teach all of us more about you.
Okay. So
these are questions that we ask everybody on this podcast. So first of all, I'd like you to reflect on something that brought you joy in the last week.
In the last week, I had a conversation with my older daughter a couple of nights ago on the phone. My wife and I just returned from a family wedding in Israel and found that to be incredibly moving. My older daughter is, by choice, her career path, her area of study is the Middle East, particularly the Palestinian conflict. She and I have somewhat conflicting views, and we had a good hour-long conversation that I found enlightening. I was floored by how articulate, insightful, convincing, calm, non-emotional, and articulate she was during that conversation. And it was just pride. It was just pure parental pride to have her convince me why she was right.
Okay. So the next question I want to move on to is, what is the best advice you've ever received?
Two things. One of the surgeons who trained me in general surgery always used to like to say, and I very much took it to heart, was be pure of heart. A second surgeon that trained me when I was training in cardiac at the Cleveland Clinic, Toby Cosgrove, used to like to say, perception is reality. And it took me a long time to really understand what that meant, but I think there's incredible wisdom and truth there.
Okay. What is a book you can recommend that helped you find joy?
Oh, okay, this one's easy. So whenever in doubt, particularly in this topic of wellness or mindfulness, I always go back to Richard Bach's Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Early 1970s, simple read, but it's absolutely still relevant today to everything that we're talking about.
And still a great bestseller. So who is someone you admire?
Again, not to harp on it, but I'd have to say my wife and my daughters. They are the most moral, most insightful, most accepting, decent people I know. The three of them are absolutely my role models.
And what are you most grateful for?
I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunities that I've had. I have a remarkable family. I have a career that I'm passionate about that keeps growing and evolving. I'm taking on this new task. I very much feel blessed to have the opportunity to not only take care of the patients, but now to try and take care of the providers that I get to work with.
How do you take time out for yourself?
I do it in snippets. My house counselor when I was in high school, my wife to this day nags me about how long the showers are that I take. I take very long showers. It's my downtime. It's when I do lots of thinking. Driving to work in the car, it's about a 15-minute drive. I try and take it in small doses. Yes, I go to the gym, try and go daily, and do things of that sort for me. But really, it's those brief moments of just being by myself and getting in my head and just letting myself think.
And the last of these questions is, what is a step listeners can take in the next 24 hours to find joy for themselves?
I'm not sure that we're curing this in 24 hours.
just a little bit of joy.
I do think mindfulness is incredibly important. I think looking in the mirror and taking a moment and pausing and thinking about your joy and thinking about what it is that brings you happiness and trying to spend more time doing that as an active, concerted effort, not passively.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to add one more question at the end, because I'm still fascinated to know, you know, you're obviously as a cardiac surgeon, you've had a very sort of specific type of area you've worked on in many years, and yet you've got this philosophical interest and background. What finally decided you to almost make the leap to sort of change a significant part of your practice so that you got involved in clinician well-being as well as cardiac surgery?
I'm not sure it was a momentary thing. I think I grew into it and evolved into it. My wife teaches Pilates. She's actually actively doing a master's degree in mindfulness as we speak. So I think this is a household conversation, wellness in general. I think the turning point for me specifically for wellness was going back to school and getting this advanced degree. My intent at that point was not wellness. But as I looked at the business models of medicine, the social issues in medicine, this was the area that I found most striking as really an area that needs help and needs work and is a space that we very much need to focus on to try and improve healthcare.
Good. Well, thank you very much indeed, Rich, for coming in. This has been a really fascinating conversation, and I'm just really hope that you continue to enjoy your work and help your colleagues. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Let's begin our walking meditation. Draw your attention to your surroundings, to your breath, to your feet. Feel your feet firmly planted on the floor. Gently begin walking slowly. Feel your right foot moving forward, then your left. And as you walk, pay attention to the sensation of the ground on your feet. Maybe the area is flat, maybe it's uneven. Paying attention to each step, your right foot, then your left foot. Noticing what's around you. Maybe there's a garden, maybe some buildings. If your mind gets distracted, just bring yourself back to where you are. always bring yourself to where you plant your feet, your right foot, then your left foot. It's okay for the mind to wander. Just consider whatever it is and bring yourself back to the present moment. Paying attention to the surroundings. Maybe there's some birds. Noticing the street or the sky above. Bringing yourself back to where you are, drawing attention to your feet on the ground. You can continue doing this as long as you like. Always bring yourself back to your feet. This concludes the narration. Please be sure to visit our website at joyofmedicine.org, where we have many more materials on wellness.